You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
Since 1967, the Gaza Strip along the West Bank has been under Israeli control. The Gaza Strip in particular has been subjected to an almost total blockade. The Israeli Defense Forces control the flow of all goods in and out of the territory and have set up a naval blockade, which has repeatedly boarded ships and arrested activists who have tried to sail to Gaza. The first such voyage was in August 2008, when two boats, the Free Gaza and the Liberty, successfully passed through the blockade. Dr. Bill Dienst has co-edited a book about that experience called Freedom Sailors. Dr. Dienst will be in Vancouver on February 19th, and we've reached him this morning in Tacoma, Washington. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, people in Vancouver.
What was the purpose of the voyage?
Well, it was, again, to test a hypothesis. You know, the Israelis took out their 8,000 settlers in 2005, and they claimed that Gaza was free. But they continued to control all the borders, all the land borders in and out of Gaza. They patrolled the airwaves, or the airway, and they also blockaded the sea. So we wanted to test that hypothesis, that if Gaza is truly free, then boats from international waters should be able to come and go freely. And so we organized a nonviolent direct action to challenge this, called the Free Gaza Movement. And so we sailed two boats through international waters directly into Gaza, and we were threatened every step along the way. We've had five successful voyages in and out of Gaza, and then subsequently the Israeli Navy has boarded and attacked subsequent attempts to reach Gaza by sea.
Now, I understand that you originally planned to write the book yourself, but then you became the editor instead. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, and actually I'm editor and co-author. I mean, I was part of this historic voyage, and when I got home, I immediately knew we had book material, and so I set out to write the story. But the problem is that there were so many dimensions to what happened, and a lot of them were clandestine, and a lot of them only different people knew different aspects of the operation, but nobody could really knew the whole story. And so it became clear to me that a better book would result if I could involve my co-passengers who knew different aspects of the operation. And so it became an international effort. We have American authors, we have Greek authors, Italian, people from the UK, Palestinians that were on shore when the boats arrived, etc. And so now we have this multidimensional story that is a chronology in that it's laid out chronologically, but it's also an anthology because it's accounted. It's if we're all sitting in a room telling different aspects of the story, the part that we each know the best about.
Why did you choose a diary form?
Because I started out my prose writing in the present tense because I wanted to capture the tension and the uncertainty of our enterprise and what it felt like. And I thought that we could best do that by writing first-hand accounts by different people, some of us writing in the present tense. And I think it reads better that way.
Sounds like a fascinating process to sort of put that whole multidimensional picture together.
I think it reads like a spy thriller novel, except for it's not a novel, it's a true story.
What was your role on board ship, Bill?
I was the medical officer, so I had two roles prior to the sailing and during the sailing. The first role was to acquire a first aid kit for each vessel. And, of course, we're not a hospital ship, so there's a limit to what you can do aboard two small vessels 70 nautical miles out in international waters that might get assaulted by the world's fourth largest navy. But we had to do the best we can. And I am on the ski patrol in my local town, and so the outdoor emergency care textbook was my manual because it deals with wilderness environments, and being out at sea is a wilderness environment. And then I was to educate my co-passengers about trauma first aid. And then our third objective was to try to acquire medical supplies to take into Gaza. So I did those three things. That was my role as medical officer.
Now, there's a A chapter in the book called Stealing Gaza's Gas by David Schermerhorn. Can you tell us about what he wrote?
Sure. David Schermerhorn lives on Orcas Island, by the way, so you know he can see Canada from where he lives. But he became familiar, you know, in about 2000, it was discovered that there were major gas reserves 20 nautical miles off the Gaza coastline. And what has become apparent is that one of the main reasons that Israel maintains this sea blockade, which also involves attacking Gaza fishermen who venture out more than 3 to 6 nautical miles, one of the reasons is because they are interested in expropriating those gas reserves. And there's technology called horizontal or diagonal drilling, where they can drill from Israeli waters but across into Gaza territorial waters and steal the gas. And it's very suspicious that is what's going on now. And David Schermerhorn documents this in detail in his chapter of that name.
When you describe writing the book, it sounds like there were a lot of different, you included a lot of different perspectives. Was there anything that surprised you in putting the book together when you heard someone else's story, having lived through it yourself, and then heard a different version or a story coming from another perspective?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of this was therapy for those of us that went through it, in that when it was all over, people went their different ways around the world, and there was no time to debrief. And sometimes there was some internal conflict because people didn't understand other aspects of the story. For example, the people that were with the boats had their own difficulties getting the boats seaworthy to pass Greek maritime inspectors, and the people that were on shore in Gaza waiting for the boats to come didn't understand why the boats were 3 weeks late. But when you read the accounts, you get a better sense of this. Another important thing that happened is that when we were at sea and we were 70 nautical miles off the Israeli coastline, all of a sudden our communication systems were totally jammed and we were cut off from the world. And there's a woman named Sharon Locke, she's an Australian activist who lives in the UK, who was with the boats all the way from Greece, and she describes how Channel 16, the Universal Distress Channel for maritime traffic, they were often hearing weird pronunciations in Hebrew and Arabic, and just before we were cut off from the world, there was this pronunciation of "they are lost, they are lost," that kept being repeated, and then all of a sudden we were cut off, and you know, so I was on the other boat, so I didn't hear that part. So there's all kinds of things in the book that are enlightening to me, as told by other witnesses who saw things from different perspectives, absolutely. And then there's the chapter from Petros Giotis, our Greek colleague, who elaborates all the clandestine techniques that the Greeks used to keep the boats hidden. And we were being chased by Israeli Mossad. They were trying to locate our boats from the very beginning. There had been an attempt to sail a ship from Cyprus into Haifa in 1988, called the PLO Ship of Return. That boat was destroyed. The engine was blown up by Israeli frogmen, and the organizers were killed in a car bomb in Cyprus in 1988. And so that was the preceding experience that we had to work under. So we were definitely running scared.
In the book, Bill, what was, for yourself and your own account of the experience, what was the most important thing for you to get across?
Oh boy, that's a difficult one. But just the preparation and my role was trying to educate my passengers to be able to react to a trauma situation without scaring the holy bejesus out of them. You know, that was one element. And just not knowing day to day, moment to moment, what was happening, and then the feeling we had when we were at sea, where we were totally exhausted, we were cut off from the world, it was darkness, the Israelis threatened that we were fully expecting the Israeli Navy to show up and latch onto our boats and haul us into prison, but we were too tired to be scared at that point. And the sun rose and there were no warships on the horizon, and then Tzipi Livni, the Israeli foreign minister, announced that they wouldn't seize the boats. And part of our only defense was international media attention. And frankly, this being the first voyage, the Israelis didn't know what to do with us, and they didn't know what they could get away with. Subsequently, after our five successful voyages in and out, one of our boats called the Dignity was rammed by the Israeli warship and nearly sunk. That was during Operation Cast Lead in 2008. And then they've subsequently hijacked every other boat, including the flotilla operation in May of 2010, where they assaulted the Mavi Marmara. They killed 9 Turkish nationals, including one dual Turkish-American citizen, and wounded about 50. And unfortunately, our American government and Western governments have been somewhat apathetic about doing anything about it, and the Israelis have been emboldened by that, and they've gotten more aggressive.
What do you hope people will get out of reading Freedom Sailors?
Well, is that ordinary people can make a difference. I think prior to our activity, it wasn't very well known around the world that Gaza was even under siege, even though since 1967 no boats had sailed into Gaza. For 41 years, we were the first ones to do that. Now there's more awareness that Gaza's under siege. Now it has reached the level of international bodies. And then there have been other activities to challenge the siege of Gaza that have been spinoffs of the Free Gaza movement. For example, the Gaza Freedom March in, I believe it was 2009, where activists assembled in Egypt and attempted to approach Gaza that way. There's the Viva Palestina movement from the UK, where they brought a convoy into Gaza. There's Code Pink activities. So this goes on and on. It's spurned other actions by other groups of ordinary people trying to make a difference. When governments fail to act, sometimes the people have to make action to try to change policy. But it's an ongoing struggle. Obviously, the siege is still on in Gaza, and I'm hoping that we can continue to raise awareness and get people to try to motivate our governments to change policy towards liberty and justice for all people in the Holy Land, whether they're Jewish, Muslim, or Christian. They need to be treated equally.
Bill, I'm going to give people information about your book tour, which will be up here in Vancouver next week. But I understand the proceeds from the book tour are going to the Gaza Ark Project. What's that?
So we've made several attempts to enter Gaza from international waters, and now the Gaza's Ark Project, which is a Canadian initiative, is an attempt to sailboats from Gaza out of Gaza with local Palestinians as well as international activists. Aboard that boat will be exports from Gaza that are trying to get to international markets. And a lot of these exports have been blocked by endless Israeli red tape. And so this is an attempt, again, to usurp. If Gaza's free, then they should be able to sail supplies, produce, or products from Gaza in international markets without the without being blocked by the Israeli Navy. And this is a harmless enterprise. It in no way threatens the security of the state of Israel. So if Israel attacks the Gaza's Ark boat, that'll hopefully continue to raise world awareness. And we would love it if it could actually successfully sail outside of Gaza. But we're going to keep trying. We keep pushing buttons. We keep challenging this blockade on every dimension. You know, when there was apartheid South Africa, it took a long time to end apartheid in South Africa, and we will continue to do whatever we can to end apartheid in the Holy Land.
Well, Bill, it's been a real pleasure talking with you this morning.
Thank you very much, Lorraine.
I've been talking with Dr. Bill Dienst. He's the co-editor of Freedom Sailors with Greta Berlin. He'll be speaking at People's Co-op Bookstore on Tuesday, February 19th. He'll be in Nanaimo at the Harbourfront Library on Wednesday, the 20th, and at the BCGEU Hall in Victoria on Thursday. And you can get more information at gazaark.org.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@cooperadio.org.